B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once described Caddyshack as an awesome documentary, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, that was quite a performance. Brooks Koepka, as he did with his U.S. Open title last summer, defended his PGA title at Bethpage Black outside New York City. No one in major championship history has held two back-to-back trophies simultaneously, and they've been doing this a long time, kids. And yet, there's criticism. Real criticism of Brooks Koepka. We'll dive into all things PGA, Bethpage, and Brooks with golf historian Peter Kessler. Also, 2 weeks ago, we had University of North Carolina head men's golf coach Andrew DiBattista on the show as he was preparing to take his Tar Heels out to Palo Alto, California for the Stanford Regional. Well, one top five finish later, and they've advanced to the NCAA tournament this weekend in Fayetteville, Arkansas. We had the chance to catch up before they hopped on a plane early this week. However, we begin as we do following each and every major with a man who logged more than 1,300 hours of live golf content as the workhorse host of the Golf Channel. From PeterKessler.com, golf historian Peter Kessler. For a major that had a wire-to-wire winner, I feel as if there are more big picture questions to be answered than usual about the venue and the participants on a couple of levels. So I thought we'd take them one at a time. Let's start with the venue. I'm a huge fan of the way Kerry Haig and the PGA of America set up their courses for their major, mostly because I never hear Kerry Haig's name over the weekend as opposed to who I hear with the USGA every year. I thought Bethpage's greens were firm, but they were receptive. I thought the rough was penal, but it was not wingfoot debilitating. The only people I heard openly complaining about the setup were those that missed the cut. I know it's only year one, but I like the move to May. They may have gotten lucky with the weather in the spring. Your thoughts first on the course itself as constituted for this major.
I don't think it worked very well because while everything that you just said is true, the size of the ballpark, the size of the golf course was actually too big for 95% of the players. You know, when you got two guys like DJ and Brooks at a site like this or a site like Shinnecock, where they also finished 1-2 last year, they have a tremendous advantage because they can carry the ball 30 yards longer than the other guys. If you have a course with rollout, you know, then it's not quite as dramatic. But when you average 8-iron for 3 straight rounds Thursday through Saturday before the Sunday wind came up and made it play a little bit longer, then you're not evidencing a complete game. So they set it up to defend against unreasonable scoring, and I think the setup was fair in the sense that you just mentioned it. But the ballpark was too big now for 95% of the field, who basically had to hit hybrid into at least 9 greens. You take the average guy in the field, including the guys who made the cut now, and guys were averaging hybrid for half the holes going around, and Brooks never hit a 7-iron, hit anything longer than a 7-iron for 3 days, nor did DJ for 3 days. So when there's a 4 and 5 club differential and only power can be rewarded, and a Corey Pavin and a Zach Johnson could never possibly win again on such a golf course as Corey did successfully in 1995, where he couldn't have, even if he was in his prime last year, have even made the cut. So because the equipment is unregulated, because the longest hitters can take disproportionate advantage of their swing speed percentage above the next guy below them, it's not going at a linear rate. It's disproportionate. So if you hit at 115 and swing at 115 miles per hour and I make one at 130, I don't get that incremental 115 to 30. I get it as though it was 115 to 170. So because the equipment is unregulated at those swing speeds, there's a couple of guys who can take advantage of it, and it's not their fault, and they're in great shape, and they're big, strong guys, but it's the nature of the swing speed reaction from the golf ball that's problematic. And guys who hit a 285 couldn't play the golf course. If you can't play the golf course hitting a 285, then there's a problem.
Let me push back with on that just in this, because I saw your tweet that came that was last night or early this morning that brought this up, and it's a valid criticism. It also echoes some other things that are being said, and that is more or less that there's no artistry to what Brooks Koepka is doing. You'd like to see a champion who has to use all the clubs in his bag, etc. Out of 150, 160 participants, I forget how many there were, only seven finished par or better. Six under par. Of those six, four of them were short knockers, comparatively speaking, to Koepka and Johnson.
Right.
Can we get into trouble regulating the game for two people? Because I just keep thinking back. I will always be just having my teeth gritted at what they did to Augusta National to, quote-unquote, tiger-proof the course.
Well, first of all, there's no denigrating Brooks Koepka. He can only play the golf course that's presented to him. And the golf course that was presented to him this week said, hit a nice hard cut off the tee, you'll have a lot of scoring clubs in. Because you have scoring clubs and you miss greens, you'll miss in the right places, which is why he was also number one in scrambling in addition to strokes gained. That's very important to know, that because his ability to hit short clubs left him ideal and easy places to miss hit shots to, that gave him a tremendous advantage. So he didn't have to hit five irons, so you can't knock him for that. The knock is that the way the equipment is today, matched with most of the golf courses, last week you had two players who hit scoring clubs into every hole. But on most weeks on the PGA Tour, everybody's hitting scoring clubs in. That's the problem. A couple of years ago when DJ won out in Hawaii, he averaged 86 yards for his approaches for 4 days. 86 yards, that's a lob wedge, not even a full one. But more interestingly, the field averaged 114 yards. The whole field averaged 114 on their approach shots. That means that the equipment in that case overpowered the golf course, so all hazards, bunkers, and other things are completely out of play because you're hitting the ball far past them. And as Brooks said, a professional would much rather hit a non-iron from the rough than a six-iron from the fairway. So you hit it as far as you can so you can have a nine-iron. When Jack Nicklaus hit it as far as he could, he didn't have nine-iron. He had five-iron, three-iron, seven-iron, one-irons into par threes, one-iron into Baltus draw for his third shot, actually, after topping a second. 1967, when he was beating Arnold and Hogan's scoring record, one iron into the green. So, that is now gone from the game, which means that there's something wrong with the equipment if all 14 clubs aren't required. You want the clubs to be used, and Brooks and DJ only have to use five or seven, but it's certainly not that fault, their fault. They were given a course, presented in a certain way, that worked incredibly disproportionately unfairly in their favor because it only rewarded distance and wouldn't reward other ways of scoring.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's continue talking about Koepka and some of the criticisms of him, which I'm sort of scratching my head about. This is not the first time that we've seen someone have a lead in a major and start to leak oil down the stretch. I'm reminded of Tiger Medina in 99, where he seemed to be coasting until there was a three-shot swing between him and Sergio, a double bogey on a par three against Sergio's birdie, and that sort of opened the door. But Tiger in 99 was able to close the deal. I believe Koepka walked off the 10th green after birding it with the same seven-shot lead that he had when he started. But four consecutive bogeys later, all of a sudden, things were starting to get interesting. But he closed the door. He finished the deal, and he won. That's all that matters, right? Or is it?
Well, of course that's all that matters. Listen, Bobby Jones said it best. We know that 18 holes is a round of golf. also know that it's not a test of golf. That's why I, Bobby Jones, like match play at 36 holes, because over 18, the other guy could get hot or you might not yet find your rhythm, but over 36 holes, the better player is always going to win in match play. He said over 72 holes in stroke play, the best player will eventually emerge if there isn't something wrong with the golf course or its setup. And in those days, there were very few complaints. Really, the only two complaints that I'm really familiar with that go all the way back is the setup in 1927 at Oakmont was heavily criticized, probably mostly because Jones finished 11th, because from 1922 through 1930, he finished first or second in every single U.S. Open he played, except 1927. And so, and in 11 of the last 12 Opens that he played, 13 of the last 21 majors that he played, he won those. That summer of 27, Tommy Armour, who won that Open at Oakmont, who was good friends with Jones, they played a whole bunch of matches together. Tommy Armour was the U.S. Open champion at Oakmont, also won the PGA, of course, and Jones started him one up for nine, and Tommy Armour lost money, and Tommy Armour said that's how damn good he was. In 1935, they played the Open at Oakmont again, the toughest course still in America, and Sam Parks, who lived in the neighborhood, went, man, I shoot a bunch of 75s, which is basically what Sam Park shot, which is why nobody's ever heard of him. He said, if I can shoot 475s at Oakmont, because he played it every day for weeks and weeks before the championship, and he was actually the first guy to do yardages. In 1935, Sam Parks kept playing nine holes every day at Oakmont for a couple of months, and he said, well, let's pace it off from the tree to the beginning of the green. And then over the course of a few weeks, he fine-tuned the system to exactly what it is today, that all the important landmarks to all the important landmarks. And so he was the guy who really started it. And guess what the winning score was? 301. Guess who the winner was? Sam Parks, averaged 75 and a quarter per round, and you never heard from him again. So really, you never hear about complaints about the golf course until recently, starting with the changes at Augusta National, because of this constant battle we have between equipment that's gotten out of hand, combined with better athletes, and a huge disparity between the longest hitters and the average hitters, which didn't used to be the case. There was a disparity, but it was proportionate. You know, Jack was longer than Gary Player, but Gary could still play with him. Gary Player could still exhibit his short game. Gary Player wouldn't be able to play today. Can you imagine a man with nine major championships not being able to compete because of the status of equipment relative to golf courses that can or cannot handle it?
Isn't that that toothpaste out of the tube, though? I mean, we can complain about it and agree about it, but there's nothing that's going to be done about it. Do you ever see a day where there's bifurcation or the equipment companies do anything?
Yeah, it's such an easy fix, too. Everybody wants to overcomplicate it, and you know, really, it's super simple. From 1993 to 2003, the average driving distance on the tour increased 10%, which was 27 yards and change. 27 yards from 1993 to 2003. Why was that? The big-headed drivers came out in the early 90s. The hardball came out in 2000. The combination gave you an additional almost 30 yards for every player in the field, proportionate through 2003. Now, since 2003... every 90 days, the ball manufacturers say our newest, hottest, longest ball ever. You know why? Because it's actually true. So the ball today, the 2019 Pro V1, actually flies at least 30 yards farther than the one they made in 2000. So that's 55 yards. Wait, who's hitting it 55 yards farther? Oh, well, let me give you an example. When Phil Mickelson was 28, he hit the ball 48 yards shorter. He has averaged at 48 over the last 12 months. He's 50 yards longer, 20 yards older, and all he does is work out at Five Guys Hamburger. So it's the
equipment. Golf historian Peter Gessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. I'm intrigued by the athletic archetype of being motivated by real, perceived, or imagined slights. Going back in golf history, Palmer felt slighted by Hogan. His response, he went out, he won the Masters. Trevino felt slighted. Tiger felt slighted by junior tournament organizers Stephen Ames and more. Koepka seems to be playing with this I feel slighted chip on my shoulder. I never once heard Jack Nicklaus say he felt slighted in any way, shape, or form. He had other ways to motivate himself, or have I just missed the slight that Jack complained about?
Well, he didn't complain about it, but he was certainly aware of it. I mean, you know, you thought people were, you know, chanting against Brooks this past weekend. There were Ryder Cups against either the European or the American side. I mean, Jack, in the very early days, particularly the early 60s, when he first joined the tour and would wear the same pair of pants for 5 days and the inside of the pockets in the front of his pants, because his thighs were so big, the inside would turn outside and come out of his pants pocket. I mean, it was a charming sight. And he wore a terrible hat. He looked awful, and he was way overweight. You know, and people held up signs in behind bunkers saying, "Fat Jack, hit it here." So he was obviously aware of it, and that certainly would serve as a motivator to say, "I'll show you." But, you know, it's really true of all artists and all really great athletes ever. They all kind of had an interesting sort of, I don't know if chip is the word, but that whenever there was a suggestion that they weren't the best at what they did, if they were the best at what they did, then that person would work real hard to set it straight, either by words or by performing another feat of magic, whether it was Houdini or Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel ceiling over a 10-year period. So, you know, it kind of goes with the territory. You know, in my own case, I know that my track record, which is really good in terms of the work I've done, you know, people will take shots at me, but I find they don't ever really take shots at the work because it's fairly bulletproof, really. I don't know how that it could have been improved upon. And that's the same is true of the performances of really the great players, you know, whether it's Muhammad Ali in his prime or Jack Nicklaus in his or Tiger in his, you know, when you're the best at what you do, there's a very, very deep arrogance that comes with it. Now, in most cases, it's a healthy arrogance. Ali understood it and was acting half the time. Jones had a very healthy arrogance, which he really kept under tabs. But, you know, in my studying Jones over a long period of time, you know, I've uncovered stuff where, you know, he said to people about match play, if you just keep making pars every hole, they'll all crack eventually. You know, and Nicklaus has said things like that, too, when it was important to him. But it's more about the healthy arrogance than it is about the chip. And it makes you just want to go out and do it again for your own pleasure and hope that you piss off a few people along the way.
Golf historian from PeterKessler.com. Peter Kessler. And up next, he continues to take dead aim at the 101st PGA Championship presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking dead aim presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. As the workhorse initial face of the Golf Channel, no one logged more on-air time in instruction, information, and interviews than this man, golf historian Peter Kessler, and we continue now with his analysis of the PGA Championship. We got to see something on Thursday and Friday that we get to see not very often. I go back to Hogan with Nicklaus at Cherry Hills in 60, Nicklaus with Tiger at Valhalla in 2000. And that's what I was reminded of on Thursday and Friday as Woods and Koepka were paired together. Now, granted, it's not a good analogy. Hogan, I guess, was still somewhat competitive, obviously, but he was past his prime. Nicklaus was competitively irrelevant in 2000. Tiger's currently the Masters champion. But you have that situation where you have the icon and the monster that they've created by their example playing with them side by side. Were we witnessing the next evolution of professional golfer on full display Thursday and Friday, or is Brooks kind of the beta version of what's still to come?
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to characterize it in an interesting way, you could certainly say that there was a kind of a passing of a torch, not that it was intended, not that anybody thought about, really. But when you look at the results and you look at Tiger's age difference of 14 years older and the stuff he's gone through, you know, you say that, you know, okay, maybe it's winding down. But then you say, excuse me, a few weeks ago, Tiger won the Masters, so get with the program. So the interesting thing to me, really, about the Brooks-Tiger pairing was that Tiger wasn't long enough to play the black at Bethpage. Tiger wasn't long enough to play the PGA Championship. Brooks was hitting 4 and 5 clubs less than Tiger. On some holes, it was 9 iron, 4 iron. That's what Tiger used to be able to do to people. But he did it on every golf course. And the rate of drive increase over the rest of the field was not nearly as great during the prime of Tiger because the equipment didn't go as far as it does now, as the advantage that Brooks and DJ have over the rest of the field.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. Peter, this is always uncomfortable to watch, but I'm somewhat fascinated by those that get paired in the last group who find out on an unfortunately big and public stage that stage is just way too big for them. Harold Varner's a local guy here from Gastonia. He's a hard worker. I had big hopes after his birdie on Sunday that, hey, this could really be a career-changing day for him. If he could somehow hold it together and get a top five, it would be huge. It was not to be. I mentioned earlier Tiger's win at 99 in Medina. He was paired with Mike Weir in that final round. Weir, I believe, shot an 80. And at that point, you know, you think, well, this guy will never hear from him again. You know, Weir was able to rebound, had a brief but solid career, including a major championship. He won the Masters. Can you think of any other Mike Weirs, guys who just choked in that first big moment, but later were able to right the ship?
Well, I mean, you know, it really happened to most players, except for the really super great ones. I mean, you know, it took Hogan 10 years to win on tour. 10 years. He turned pro in 1930, won in 1940, and we know the rest of the story. But, you know, some guys just take a long time to get there. But generally, great players are identified fairly early on. And in Brooks's case, he wasn't. You know, he's not a late bloomer. It was just a different approach, which I really approve of. Went from Kazakhstan to India to Pakistan to far-flung, obscure places with how does the money work? Where do I get food? What should I eat? What can't I eat? Can you drink the water? I mean, how do you get to the golf course? How can I converse with people? How does it work here? So he's been through so much stuff that makes you tougher. He's already tough. You can't show up untough and then become tough. You know, Trevino was tough as a little boy, and he's tough today. So, you know, the Brooks thing to me, you know, really feels legit that, you know, this 4 or 5 year trajectory that he's been on, you know, you can clearly see the benefits of what he's done. And I think that this is sustainable. But yet I do believe, going back to your previous question, that there is a bit of a passing of a torch feeling this past weekend in the sense that it's not a goodbye by Tiger, but it's a nod, this is the next great guy. I mean, in 1920, at the U.S. Open, Harry Vardon was 50 years old, and he almost won the golf tournament, did bad weather, and 3-putting down the last 9 cost him, and Ted Ray won. Bobby Jones was playing in his first U.S. Open as an 18-year-old. So was Gene Sarazen, who were both born in 1902. And Jones and Vardon played together, and, you know, Vardon made Jones possible in a sense. And Jones was aware of Vardon and had seen Vardon swing and already had the same swing really at 6. Bobby Jones did that he would later have at 26 if you compare photos. But so then it was just an acknowledgement by Bobby that I know what you did, Harry, and I'm appreciative and I'm going to try to do the same thing. And Harry basically said, go get him, boy, you've got a great game. So, you know, every one of those situations has a slightly different flavor to it. Jack could still play in 2000. He had finished tied 6th at 58 in the 1998 Masters, beating Tiger Woods in 1998, who was the defending champion who had won by 12 strokes the year before. So Jack may not have been particularly relevant, but he could still play.
Peter, I know you hate tournament speculation, and I'm not asking for it here, but barring any unforeseen changes in equipment in the next month, is there any reason that you would have to have anybody's names ahead of DJ and Koepka heading into Pebble Beach? And do you think Pebble Beach, knowing the setup that the USGA has, will it be more open to more competitors than what we just witnessed at Bethpage?
Well, yes. The answer to the second part of the question is yes. It will be open to many more competitors because it's very much significantly shorter. And you don't have to hit driver. You know, first hole, I mean, you know, some guys want to get in a long iron and an 8-iron into the first green. So Brooks isn't going to need to hit drivers all the way around to have that edge. But he can hit 3 woods past the other guy's 3 woods. So he's always going to have the distance edge, but he may not need to do it with his driver. Same for DJ. I think that Brooks is a more cerebral player than DJ is, and I think that the ever-changing situations on every shot at Pebble, particularly with, you're talking about greens that are 3,500 square feet on average. Tour average is 7,500 square feet. A Coore and Crenshaw green average is 10,000 square feet. So, you know, the greens are tilted at Pebble, and they're going to be fast, and they're really going to be small. And so you really want to hit something with loft in there. But Brooks is still going to be able to do that without having to risk hitting driver into a problematic area. So in some ways, his advantage may even be increased, but because he can hit shorter clubs, the other guys can use drivers freely where he uses a 3-wood. And again, he has the advantage because you're going to hit your 3-wood straighter than your driver. That's why Nicklaus hit 3-woods many, many more times than he hit drivers in major championships. So, but yes, many more players can win than two this week because unbridled hitting with scoring clubs, second shots for two guys, and hybrids for the rest of the field won't be the case at Pebble. You know, second green is reachable in two, 18 is reachable in two, six is generally not reachable in two. You got to hit, you know, you're going to hit some 6-irons, you're going to hit, you know, a pitching club into seven. So, you know, it's definitely going to give more guys a chance to win, and the big hitters are going to have to throttle back, which will actually end up helping them because you hit less club, you have a higher chance of hitting your target.
Get you out of here on this. Completely unrelated to the championship. Golf historian Peter Kessler, our guest, taking Dead Aim. I love the vignettes you've been tweeting from your treasure trove of interviews over the years. There's so much more, by the way, if you haven't visited Peter's website at peterkessler.com. It's just fantastic. There are times when you, as a broadcaster, I can see in your eyes and body language, you're basically saying, oh, my God. This is great. I'm so glad I'm here for this. Please, God, tell me there's film in the camera. This was especially true with the Paul Runyon, Sam Snead stuff that I saw you post. You were giddy with what was actually going on right in front of you. In all the times with all the people that you've been with and interviewed, what was the time that you were caught off guard in terms of how good it was? In other words, you got done and said, wow, this was so much better than I ever imagined it could be.
Well, my imagination threshold was fairly high. I really, and this I know sounds completely insane, but I really mean it when I say it. When I got there to the Golf Channel at the end of 94, before we did the first show, Arnold and I, on January 17th of 95, and I got to meet people in the hallway and stuff, I realized that I was the only one who knew anything about golf. Certainly nobody was going to know as much or more. That was a statistical impossibility, but nobody knew anything. And then there wasn't anybody who knew anything about, like, hosting shows or doing TV or writing the shows and stuff. So I went, well, I could do that. And so I watched, like, some Bob Costas' HBO shows on called Later, and I said, I can definitely do better than that. And I watched 4 or 5 different guys. I said, I can do much better than all these people. And I went, so what do you think? And I sat at home every day and I thought about it. And then finally I went, you know, I said, really, it's like, I feel like Michelangelo the day that Pope Julius II walked him into the Sistine Chapel and showed him this cavernous ceiling and said, you know, this is what I would like you to paint. And then, you know, Michelangelo after that, you know, had a chance to sit and look up and go, wow, I know what to do here. I know I can do this. this is exactly what I want to do. And for some reason, I absolutely know exactly how to do this. And so that was how I felt. It was completely insane because I hadn't had any particular experiences that would suggest that I would walk into the opening of a new TV channel, host its first show live with the most popular player in the history of the game, and basically shoot a course record 61 or 62. And so, you know, my expectation level was very high, but I met it 1,298 times out of 1,300 times, and there's only 20 minutes of the other 2 hours of shows that I would take back and just do slightly differently. So, yeah, I mean, I expected it to meet my test, and my test is super-duper high, and if it meets my test, then I know it's going to meet everybody else's test. And the weird thing about those shows were a couple things. One, they always seemed like they were in slow motion, so I never felt in a rush to do the next thing. I felt like I had oodles and oodles of time, even though it was live and you didn't have any time. And that the requirement was whatever you say in the next 2 seconds has to be the same thing you would say if you had the rest of your life to think about what you're going to say in the next 2 seconds, but you have to do it right now. I really enjoyed that pressure. The other thing was I frequently felt like I was sitting in a third chair kind of watching the show, you know, and like evaluating the show. And sometimes I actually thought I saw me sitting on the other side of the room giving me suggestions or nudging me to sit a different way. I mean, it was, you know, one of the, you know, eeriest experiences ever. But, you know, the whole thing was fantastic. And I was, you know, if there's such a thing as a zone for that kind of work, I went into the zone on January 17th, 1995. They didn't come out of it until they threw me out the door at the beginning of 02.
I say it every time, but there is no one, no one who has the perspective and historical insight that man does. From PeterKessler.com, that's golf historian Peter Kessler. And when we return, we try to provide the same good luck as his last appearance. University of North Carolina head men's golf coach Andrew DiBattista takes dead aim at his Tar Heels, and they're competing this weekend in the NCAA tournament in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Andrew DiBattista is in his second year as head men's golf coach of the University of North Carolina Tar Heels, and for the second year in a row, he leads them into the NCAA championships this weekend. We had a chance to catch up right before he and the team left for Arkansas earlier this week. All right, so when last we talked, you were getting set to hop on a plane out to San Francisco and, of course, the Stanford Regional in Palo Alto. You get out there on Friday. What is your preparation routine? Did you actually go to the Stanford golf course, or did you prepare somewhere else?
We had another terrible trip. We just got to hang out, spend some time at San Francisco Golf Club. That was on Friday. Just an absolutely terrible, no, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Obviously, you know, high profile golf course, and going into it, I don't know why. I feel like the stereotype on that is, and it's a little bit stuffy. And we got there and it was absolutely amazing. The people were phenomenal. The golf course was great. I mean, we can't say enough good things about, especially the people that were there. They were so warm, so welcoming. So we had a really good time there. That was Friday. Saturday, we went to Olympic Club. We did not play the actual course. We took them over to the Cliffs, the par 3 course, which was, again, just stunning. We just went around it one time, and guys had so much fun. Some of them went around it again for a second time. I mean, just gorgeous views, obviously, the cliffs. So you're literally on a cliff, and, you know, below you is the beach and the ocean and all that. And you and I have talked about this before. I think regionals is an exciting week. It's a fun week, but it's also a stressful week. So our plan was to just go out there and, you know, yes, kind of get used to the climate and the grass and all of that, but really just take stress off, let the guys kind of enjoy themselves, give them a different experience, and just kind of really have some fun out there. And that's what we accomplished for the first 2 days. It couldn't have been any better. Set the tone for a great week, and then we got into it with the practice round on Sunday.
Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina. He's our guest taking dead aim. As I was looking at how well your team performed, one thing that crossed my mind was something we discussed when it came to conference, as opposed to what you experienced in regionals, and you kind of just touched on it. conference always falls in the heat of finals. And, you know, don't forget the student part of student athlete, and that's no joke at the University of North Carolina. The difference with regionals is finals are over, and the guys are actually as stress-free as you're probably going to find them all year, and they could just go out and have fun playing golf, and I think that may have made a huge difference.
Yeah, no, it was a big difference for us, and like you mentioned, the last time you and I talked, we had the conversation about conference, and, you know, there's something that all of us can learn from that. But so much of that I put on me and the schedule that we created for our guys. And, you know, for the most part, yeah, we're with them at all times. But they're the ones that have, you know, their schedule's even more jam-packed than ours because they're in classes and they're studying, they're writing papers and all that. So probably a little bit of mismanagement on my part. You know, we'll take care of that in the future. But you know, the guys also look at it and see, okay, so how can I be better? Where can I manage my time better? You know, how can I hit my wedges closer? How can I make more putts? All that stuff. But yeah, when you get past that and they're done with final exams, there's just this, especially at this place, right? Top five public academic institution in the country. There's just this weight. Like you can see it literally coming off the guys. Like they show up to the facility, they got a pep in their step. They got smiles on their faces, and they're just ready to go because they know that, you know, for the most part, they're just locked in completely on golf and getting their minds ready and getting their bodies ready. So it's a lot of fun.
You can't win a golf tournament on the first days. You can't get into the NCAAs on the first day, but you can play yourself out of it or definitely dig yourself a big hole. I know that's what every coach is thinking. God, just let us have a solid first day. You had better than a solid first day.
It was an okay day. It was a weird day because, you know, you paid attention to our team enough, especially this year. You know, we got some horses, and Austin Head has been absolutely spectacular, you know, still kind of on pace to break the Carolina single-season scoring average record. You know, he didn't have a great day in round one. Ryan Gerard was okay. Ryan Burnett, you know, not that great of a day. And our five guy, and you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes, you know, Dougie Ergood's in our five spot. He goes out and shoots 66. Our four guy happens to be a senior All-American. You know, he goes out and shoots 68. And those two guys carried the weight for us that day. And if it wasn't for them, I don't know where we would have been on the leaderboard, but we would have been digging out of a serious hole. You know, so the cool part is those two guys picked us up. And then in round two, it was a little bit more of the norm for us. So Ryan Burnett played well. Austin Hitt played well. Ryan Gerard was very solid. Josh was very solid. And then in the final round, you get an absolutely amazing round by a freshman, Ryan Burnett, goes out and shoots 63. You pair that up with a bunch of other guys that had really nice, solid rounds, and off we go to the national championship.
Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina, our guest taking dead aim. As you're coming off of round one and even round two, and especially coming off of round two where you can smell it now, you know where you are on the leaderboard. You've got a pretty good idea about what it's going to take on that third day to finish in the top five to get to regionals. What is your preparation that night? Do you talk about it much? Do you not talk about golf at all? What is the situation with you and your team? How did you handle it this time?
Well, my belief on it is I don't care if you're in first place, fourth place, sixth place, eighth place. Like, that final round at regionals is the most fun but probably the most stressful day of the year. And I think you can handle it two ways. You can not talk about it and pretend like it doesn't exist, or you can talk about it and you can talk to the guys about, you know, how to handle it, how to deal with it, how to be resilient, all that stuff. And I prefer option two because I think that's more reality. So when they show up on the first tee and all of a sudden they're nervous and they're shaking, at least you had a conversation with them about, hey, this is normal. Like, this is what you're supposed to feel. And, oh, by the way, if you feel this, this is a really good thing. This is what you need to embrace because, you know, a team that's sitting at home or a team that's in 12th place, they don't have that feeling, right? So the fact that we are under pressure, you know, and in this situation, like, this is all a really, really good thing. So let's embrace this. Let's enjoy it. You know, let's go compete our rears off. And the good thing is this is kind of who we are and the culture that we have. We talk about this not just at regionals. We talk about this every tournament. We almost talk about it every day. But just loving competition, embracing challenges, being resilient, overcoming adversity, kind of winning the inner battle with yourself, right? So if things don't go your way, don't sulk and whine and have the pity party. Like, just keep fighting. Keep your composure, be poised, and just keep fighting. And I feel like that's, it's really interesting at regionals because we saw it last year with some of the teams we played with. We saw it this year with some of the teams that we played with. And these are really good teams. These are teams that are ranked in, you know, the top 10, top 15. And, like, those teams should breeze through. No problem at all just based on talent. But you can see their guys, they get rattled, and you can see them get tight, and you can see them not just react to shots and, like, I mean, like, average shots. It's not like it's a terrible shot, but there's this big, like, overreaction, like, negative outburst. So you can see the stress hitting guys, and, you know, this may not be the case every single year, but so far these last 2 years, even the year before that, our guys have done a really nice job kind of handling those circumstances and those emotions.
Thank you for bringing up past teams, because with the team not in the room right now and you able to just talk, just you, me, and a couple of girls hanging around here. 2 years ago, I really felt like the program, you know, sort of knocked a door down. You got to the NCAAs. Last year's team, you expected to be there. This year has to be extremely gratifying no matter what happens in Arkansas this weekend, because of course, the expectation and the hope is that you get to this point. But this is really an accomplishment for this team, this young team, to do what it did this year, to get back to the NCAAs.
Yeah, a lot of people have that thought, and a lot of people have that feeling. And, 5 weeks ago, we won our home tournament. We were on a really nice stretch, had some top four finish and win, and then a second against the great field. And we had a lot of people reach out with all these very nice, positive things to say. And, some people called it, a rebuild. Hey, can't believe what you guys are doing during a rebuild. And it is a compliment. They meant it as a compliment, but that's not how we think. Like, we are building. We are always building to become one of the best programs in the country. And I don't care who's on our roster. I don't care who's in our starting lineup. Those five guys and all of our guys, they will have a certain attitude. They will have a certain mindset, and it will be all about, we believe in ourselves. We know that we're going to get the job done, and let's go get the job done. Yes, I think to your point, we had – this actually catches people off guard, but we, out of our five guys at regionals, three of them have never seen an NCAA regional before. So we had a sophomore and two freshmen that had never experienced that. And again, they handled it really well. You give them credit. I think it's what we kind of do on a daily basis. It's what we do throughout the year to prepare guys for these moments so that they don't get in these situations. I don't care if it's an ACC championship, a regional, national, a major championship, their first PGA Tour event, that they know that they're ready to go. They know that they're prepared. They know that they've done all of the things necessary to be very ready to be successful in that moment.
As we're recording this conversation, Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina. Our guest taking dead aim. As we're recording this conversation, you're getting ready to hop a plane to head to Arkansas. It's early in the week. When do the actual rounds start? And sort of explain to people how the NCAA works, because there's a couple of rounds of medal play to qualify for the match play portion.
Yeah. So our schedule is going to be very similar to the regionals. We're going to stick with the same belief, the same philosophy. We're going to fly out of here early tomorrow morning. We're going to go to Little Rock, which is actually about 3 hours away from the site of the national championship. We're going to go down there. We're going to see the Lacing Club, which is, I believe, like a top 30, top 40 course. We've heard it's unbelievable. A lot of people compare it to Augusta. Next, we're going to stay in Little Rock. Next morning, we're just going to practice at a local course that was very kind to us, and they're going to host us. That's Wednesday morning. Wednesday afternoon, we're going to drive up to Fayetteville, and that's where the women's championship match will be going on. And what they do is they allow the men's teams to basically walk the golf course as if we are spectators. So we'll kind of see it for the first time, watch a little bit of the women's match. The next day is the marathon day. You get the practice round with 30 teams on the golf course.
Oh, boy.
At the same time. And then Friday, that's when it all starts. So I believe we are in the morning, then afternoon wave. So round one Friday, we'll be teeing off in the morning. Round two on Saturday will be in the afternoon. After that, it depends on obviously how you play. So the third round is on Sunday. That's when they cut it from 30 teams to 15 teams. And then on Monday, that's when it goes live on the Golf Channel. You'll have two things going on. You'll have an individual national champion crown, and then you'll also be cutting the final 15 teams. You'll be cutting them to eight, the top eight for match play. Tuesday, you'll have the quarterfinal matches and the semifinal matches. And then Wednesday, you'll have the national championship match live on the Golf Channel.
You going to dance with the same five dance partners you took out to regionals, or will there be requalifying?
Nope, same five. We're locked in and ready to go.
Best of luck to that man, Andrew DiBattista, head men's golf coach of the University of North Carolina, and his Tar Heel team as they compete for the NCAA championships beginning this weekend. I'd also like to thank golf historian Peter Kessler of PeterKessler.com for his time and keen insight into the PGA. A reminder, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now, links to all sorts of cool information regarding Brooks Koepka and his PGA Championship win, and also the latest equipment on tour update as well. Oh, and please, please, take a minute this weekend, Memorial Day weekend, and reflect on all the souls throughout our nation's history who have paid the ultimate sacrifice for the freedoms we enjoy. They are all heroes beyond description. Weather-wise, well, welcome to summer in the Carolinas. H-O-T hot. So no issues finding a way to tee it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And hey, if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.